It is Tuesday, December 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the status of a Chinese telecom executive under arrest in Canada continues to impact relations between the United States and China. A new study says anti-Semitism is on the rise in the European Union.
And it tells the story of a gravely worsening situation in the European Union.
And we hear about a program that eases musicians' pain. It's all ahead. Chinese and American negotiators Tuesday discussed a timetable for trade talks. It followed an agreement by Presidents Donald Trump and Xi Jinping of China to impose a 90-day truce in their tariff battle. The U.S. is set to raise tariffs on $200 billion of Chinese imports from 10% to 25% next month. At the same time, another court hearing in Vancouver, Canada, Tuesday will determine the fate of the chief financial officer of Chinese giant telecom Huawei, whether Meng Wanzhou should be granted bail for health reasons as she awaits extradition proceedings to face U.S. charges of sanctions violations. The arrest December 1st has angered Beijing, which has demanded her immediate release. Philip Levy is a former Bush administration trade advisor, adjunct professor at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University, and senior fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty he believes the Meng case will impact the trade talks.
Both the U.S. and the Chinese side have tried to say that this will have no effect, no appreciable effect on the trade talks that are going on. I find that somewhat hard to believe, that there'd be no effect whatsoever. My understanding is that the Chinese are quite upset about this, and that will come out one way or the other.
This has really roiled the markets worldwide.
I think this has helped roil the markets. I think you've had a number of things where markets had initially assumed that all was well after the Trump and Xi summit, and I think we've had a series of revelations since which have cast doubt on this. And the fact that at U.S. request, the CFO of Huawei was getting arrested almost at the same time that the leaders were meeting may have been sort of the coup de grace.
What happened following the Xi-Trump meeting in Buenos Aires?
A number of things happened. So first, there were notable discrepancies between what President Trump had said was agreed in the meeting and what the Chinese were describing in the meeting. And then you started getting discrepancies between what part of the Trump White House said and what another part of the Trump White House said. So the idea that there was a clear plan to defuse the dispute started to look more and more dubious.
At the same time, a Chinese court Monday ordered a ban on iPhone sales in a patent dispute. Do you see any linkage at all?
There's no obvious linkage, and to my knowledge, they didn't claim any linkage. It also gets a little bit complicated because that was something that was done at the request of one U.S. company that hurt another U.S. company, because it was part of an intellectual property dispute. I think it is a useful reminder that for anyone who thought that the limit to China's response was how many imports they could put tariffs on, there's a lot more that China can do should they choose to.
Because of China's practices, many countries, not just the U.S., are really alarmed at Chinese technology companies like ZTE and Huawei getting involved in future networking in these countries. Where does this go?
I think this is a real problem for the Chinese. They've, for a long time, wanted to establish national brands. And I think now they may be starting to understand that part of what they need with the brand identity is they need to have people feel comfortable with those companies and have people think that those companies are operating on a commercial basis, not on behalf of the Chinese government. I don't think you have that level of comfort at the moment with Huawei and ZTE.
Philip Levy of Northwestern University and the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. A bomb attack on an Afghan security convoy kills 13 people. President Donald Trump says the U.S. southern border is secure, but he wants funding for a wall. Slain journalist Jamal Khashoggi is among a group of journalists named by Time magazine as the Person of the Year, and China detains a former Canadian envoy. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
In a minute.
41 years ago, NASA launched its ambitious Voyager mission that sent two spacecraft into deep space. The original mission goal for Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 was to explore our solar system's great outer planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. But once their original mission ended, the two spacecraft continued traveling toward the edge of the solar system, albeit in two separate directions. In August 2012, Voyager 1 became the first human-made vehicle to exit our solar system and enter interstellar space. Now, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory is reporting that Voyager 2 has joined its twin spacecraft in the space between the stars. While Voyager 1 still does communicate with Earth, Voyager 2 also has a working instrument that the space agency says will provide the first observations of entering interstellar space. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the United Nations launches a multi-billion dollar appeal for Syrian refugees and hosting countries. Breaking days of silence on violent nationwide protests that have shaken France, President Emmanuel Macron went on national television to promise a raft of immediate and longer-term measures, including raising minimum wage and speeding up tax cuts that aim to shore up struggling workers and retirees. As Lisa Bryant reports for VOA from Paris, it remains unclear whether his promises of relief will be enough to end a nearly month-long crisis that has cost the French economy billions of dollars and shaken his 18-month-old government.
President Emmanuel Macron appeared pale and subdued as he spoke on primetime TV Monday night. He vowed to restore calm, pledging zero tolerance to the rioting that has erupted in Paris and elsewhere. But he also said he understood years of pent-up frustrations that have been unleashed with the so-called Yellow Vest demonstrations.
D'abord, l'état d'urgence économique et sociale.
Macron announced a so-called state of economic and social emergency. He promised immediate measures, starting with raising minimum wage by 100 euros a month next year and rescinding a hike in pension taxes. He also urged employers to pay tax-free year-end bonuses to their workers. And he announced the start of a national dialogue on the way forward that would take place in towns across the country.
Sans doute. N'avons-nous pas su depuis un an et demi,
Macron also acknowledged mistakes in the way his government has pushed through a raft of reforms aimed to reboot the economy. People felt left out, he said, and the government had been too slow in giving people the dignity to live through their work. The president's popularity has plummeted in recent weeks, with critics claiming he is aloof and out of touch with the concerns of ordinary French. But Macron said his primary concern was for France and the French people. Macron spoke just 2 days after the fourth straight weekend of sometimes violent national protests that sent 125,000 people to the streets last Saturday, including 10,000 in Paris alone. The fallout of the rioting has been extensive. Stores looted, monuments defaced, businesses tumbling at the start of the holiday season. France's economy minister, Bruno Le Maire, called the yellow vest demonstrations an economic catastrophe. Immediate reaction to Macron's announcements was mixed. Interviewed on French TV, several yellow vest representatives and political opponents denounced the measures as insufficient. Others said they were good first steps. Commentators said they appear to mark a turn since Macron took office last year. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
A new report says anti-Semitism in the European Union is worsening and Jews are fearing increased harassment. The study was conducted by the EU Agency for Fundamental Rights, which is based in Vienna, Austria. Michael O'Flaherty is the director of the FRA, and he tells me about the report's findings.
This survey of Jews' experience of anti-Semitism is actually the largest survey of its kind ever conducted in the world. And it tells a story of a gravely worsening situation in the European Union. The vast majority, almost 90% of the surveyed Jews, said that anti-Semitism is the biggest problem they face in their lives. And again, a large majority were of the view that it's getting worse and has gotten considerably worse over the past 5 years. I should say that when I talk about the respondents who engaged with us, they were carefully selected from across 12 EU member states to capture the views of pretty much the entire Jewish community in any one of the European 28 member states.
Is it known the reasons for this? Why is this occurring now?
You know, that's more difficult to analyze. It's not something that you can well capture in the survey. What you can capture are questions such as what form do these acts of anti-Semitism take? Who are the perpetrators? Who do they consider to be the perpetrators? And of course, you can compare data across countries. So you can do that kind of analysis. So what do we know from this? We know that there's an increase in online expressions of anti-Semitism. We know that there are more problems in the media. And of course, we know there's a continuation of all of those attacks in real life that you would have expected, the slogans on the walls, the insults on the streets. We see very little change in general terms in who is believed to be the attacker, the perpetrator, over the past 5 years. About a third of people said they didn't know. More or less a third said it was somebody from an extreme right or left-wing position, and the remainder more or less motivated by extreme Islamic thought. Now, what's interesting in that piece of knowledge is the fact that it's more or less the same answer we got in 2012. So all this talk about how migration has created a major problem of anti-Semitism in Europe is not confirmed by this evidence.
That's very, very interesting. Well, another thing that you found in this survey is that some respondents say they are reluctant to take part in Jewish events or visiting Jewish sites because they're frightened to.
Yeah, that's right. A significant number of people who would normally wear some form of distinguishable clothing, like a kippah or some other symbolic dress of that kind, a significant number of those have said that they will often and on occasion choose not to wear something that distinguishes them because of fear of some form of attack. I mean, I think that's absolutely shocking in this day and age in Europe. It's as shocking as the levels of security that Jews say that they need for protection in their own society. And by the way, there, a majority say that the EU member states are not doing enough to protect them.
Does your survey or do you advocate any ways that these countries or the EU itself as a whole can improve the situation?
Oh, certainly. There's some very clear things that we need to act on and we can act on straight away. First, we have got to get much more serious about providing security for Jewish communities. And by the way, that's not about co-financing it or letting them purchase the security. They're as entitled to protection as anybody else. So we've got to deliver that protection everywhere. Second, we have got to do a better job of chasing perpetrators and prosecuting them. Anti-Semitism is a criminal act under EU law. So first, we've got to make sure that that EU requirement is reflected in all of the member states. But then even when it's reflected, we've got to act on it. We have to encourage Jewish people to report incidents because most of them don't because they don't believe it'll achieve anything. Then once they've reported, it needs to be investigated, it needs to be prosecuted, and those who are guilty need to be held accountable. And that's still a long way to go in too many places. And still another action that we need is to get much more serious about educating our whole communities about anti-Semitism, above all by telling the story of the Holocaust. As the Holocaust recedes further into the past, and as the survivors disappear, that story is not being sufficiently well told. And we know from recent work in Europe, not from my agency, but from others, we know that a remarkable number of people in our communities, and in particular children, know next to nothing about the Holocaust. If we can redress that, then we can put a new energy into helping our societies understand that anti-Semitism is an outrage that can never be tolerated under any circumstances.
Michael O'Flaherty, director of the EU Agency for Fundamental Rights, speaking from Vienna. The United Nations is appealing for $5.5 billion to support millions of Syrian refugees and the neighboring countries hosting them in the coming years. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN praises Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt, and Iraq for their support in offering asylum and protection to millions of refugees from Syria, which is now in its eighth year of crisis. But the support, they say, has taken a heavy toll on the economies and development of these host countries. The global body says conditions for both the refugees and the communities in which they live have deteriorated since Syria's civil war broke out in 2011. It says 70% to 80% of the refugees live under the poverty line. Children are deprived of education, and many are forced to work to help them and their families survive. The UN Refugee Agency's director for the Middle East and North Africa, Amin Awad, says the war in Syria has, for the most part, ended. As the situation improves, he says, some refugees are going home.
There are many obstacles that are on the way of return inside Syria, and we are working with the government of Syria, with other countries neighboring Syria, and with the international community at large to help remove these obstacles for return and create environments that are conditioned for the return of refugees. Until then, we repeat, we ask the donors to stay the course.
Awad says Syria is far from stable, with conflicts continuing in places such as Idlib and erupting in others. He says the refugee crisis is far from over. That means both the Syrians living in neighboring countries and their host communities will require international support for the foreseeable future. The UNHCR says nearly 117,000 refugees have returned spontaneously to Syria since 2016. This is a fraction of the 5.6 million refugees still living in exile. The UN agencies say the appeal will provide the refugees with health, water, sanitation, food, education, psychosocial support, community services, and other essential relief. Assistance also will be given to nearly 4 million people in the communities hosting them. They say those communities are under great strain. Humanitarian operations, they say, will be geared toward assisting them through livelihoods and economic opportunities, as well as basic services and support to help local institutions and municipalities function better. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. Like athletes who become injured while playing sports, many musicians suffer occupational pain, repetitive strain, and overuse injuries. But unlike sports injuries, there's a stigma attached to being hurt while playing music, so some musicians don't seek the help they need. That's why the Peabody Institute of the Johns Hopkins University founded the Johns Hopkins Center for Music and Medicine. As Faiza Almasri tells us, the center uses a holistic wellness model to better care for the performers. VOA's Faith Lapidus narrates.
Chelsea Strayer, a freshman at Peabody Conservatory, plays double bass.
I try to get in about like 3 hours a day of practicing, plus on top of, you know, having other rehearsals for a few hours normally every day.
The long hours and intensity of the repetitive movement caused her pain.
I've had pain in my arm before here, but it's never been in my wrist area before. And I've gotten bruising quite a few times now in the same place in my hand. But telling my teacher, like, okay, I'm getting pain in my wrist, like, I can't play. Like, this is starting to hurt a lot. And him being so concerned, he was like, okay, well, you need to go and get this checked out.
Strayer went to the Center for Music and Medicine Clinic located on campus. She met with co-founder Sarup Bashtepa Gray, who referred her to the clinic for tissue therapy.
The tissue therapy, basically it is a stretching, strengthening, soft tissue massage, and some physical agent modalities like cold, heat, and all that good stuff. What that does is that helps promote tissue healing.
She says musicians' injuries are more common than most people realize. They range from tendonitis to sprains.
4 out of 5 musicians who play an instrument will get injured during their career at least once. Out of these 4, 1 will recover and get back merrily to playing their instrument. Out of the remaining 3, 2 will continue playing but will have chronic problems with acute episodes along the way. And unfortunately, 1 will discontinue their art because of injury.
Bashtepa Gray, a medical doctor who plays the guitar, is familiar with both the joy and pain of playing an instrument. She says some instruments cause more pain than others.
Harp, piano, guitar are among the top. Also high strings, violin, viola. They are the most injurious. The least injurious instruments are brass for the arms.
Having a clinic on campus, says Associate Dean Sarah Hoover, sends a message to their students and fellow musicians.
There's a culture of shame and stigma associated with being injured as a musician. So the establishment of our clinic here at Peabody, the establishment of the Center for Music and Medicine, and the establishment of a whole bunch of new educational programs has really been to address this need. And it's a need for public awareness, for specialized health care, and it's a need to create a model where we integrate training and teaching with medical care so that we get a full circle of care.
To create this full circle, Hoover and her team have developed an online program that will soon become a valuable resource to help injured musicians beyond the Peabody Conservatory. More attention is also given to the orientation process of rehabilitation so the treated musicians aren't injured again when they go back to work.
So in order to be able to do that, one of the ideas is to create an instrument specialist position to work within the clinic in the interdisciplinary team with the doctors, the therapists, so that they can help the injured musician, especially in gradually getting back to play.
On the prevention side, Johns Hopkins biomedical engineers and neurologists are now working to develop a new smart guitar that will measure how much pressure a guitarist is placing on his or her arm and fingers while playing.
This, I'm hoping, will inform us both in creating preventive programming so that musicians don't injure, but also I think it would be valuable in training musicians so that they can develop certain motor skills more quickly without a lot of repetition.
Bashtepa Gray says this approach can help the performers enjoy what they like most, playing music without suffering injuries. For writer Faiza El-Masri in Baltimore, Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Thank you, Faith, and that is our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.